Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mike, and I'm from Johns Hopkins University. And today, I would like to start a conversation with you, or a discussion, regarding the use of ECG, or electrocardiograms, in cryptography for implantable medical devices. To begin our discussion, let's briefly define what an implantable medical device is. It's not your typical PC, and in fact, it's a battery-powered embedded system surgically placed inside the body. It provides diagnosis and therapy for some medical condition, and it must fail open in the event of emergency. Now, these devices are often equipped with wireless interfaces to facilitate monitoring and control. In addition, these devices are becoming increasingly integrated and networked, falling under the moniker of the Internet of Things. Unfortunately, with the benefit that comes with wireless communication, comes the additional cost of an increased attack surface. So seminal work has shown that there exist flaws that enable unauthorized control of wireless communication. And simply put, what this means is that a malicious adversary can compromise the safety and the privacy of the patient. And so that brings us to our talking point today. Lack of security mechanisms may have severe consequences for patients with implantable medical devices. Researchers have approached this problem not through traditional security mechanisms such as public key infrastructure, but rather through mechanisms that rely on things such as physiological values. Now you might think, what is a physiological value? Well, it's simply put, a biometric or something that you are. Now, the most commonly used physiological value in this context is the electrocardiogram, or the electrical signals of your heart. And this is because of the reported time-varying properties and chaotic nature of the heart. Believe it or not, it can provide us true randomness. So the research question that we pose here is now as follows, is do electrocardiogram-based protocols provide security in real-world settings? How much can we do with this true randomness, and are we using it appropriately? So, well, some researchers have looked at this, and they pointed out that using the entire ECG signal results in noisy measurements or waveform distortion that can cripple any sort of sense of security. And this is precisely why researchers recommend the use of interpulse interval. Now, interpulse interval is the time between two consecutive R peaks, or simply put, the time between two heartbeats. It's the most prominent feature of the ECG signal. And what that means, or what that buys us, is that it can be reliably measured anywhere on the body. So we get past this waveform distortion by using interpulse interval. So what else is nice about this, then? If you can measure this anywhere, it provides us a sort of this input into any security mechanism such that we can use it as a building block for, say, key distribution, generation, authentication, or even proximity detection. Because as the time varies over these signals, you can actually detect if a device is on the person, because it shouldn't be able to remotely measure these interpulse intervals. So let's go ahead and fine-tune that first research problem that I said. Get away from the electrocardiogram base and be more specific. Let us say, do interpulse interval-based protocols provide security in real-world settings? Well, my hypothesis and my co-author's hypothesis is no, it doesn't. And we are going to test our hypothesis via an analysis of authentication protocols one authentication protocol that uses the interpulse interval. And this authentication protocol is called heart-to-heart. Now, heart-to-heart authenticates a patient's implantable medical device and a clinician's programmer, or a trusted device in this model, by sampling or measuring 15 consecutive interpulse intervals. These intervals are then quantized or converted to a binary representation, where the least four bits are described as being independently and identically distributed. Nice property for crypto, right? And so what we end up seeing, and sorry I wasn't hitting the next button on here, but these are those R peaks that I was talking about, and you might imagine that I'm measuring 1 to 15, and I'm getting some bits because I'm quantizing them. And what we end up seeing out of this, or what's been reported by researchers, is that, hey, we look at these four least significant bits, and we're getting full entropies. This is great. We should use these. But I've mentioned earlier that there's one little problem here. These last four bits, they might give you nice entropy or full entropy, but you can't take it purely as it is. You have to look at the characteristics of the signal over time. So we're actually interested in statistical characteristics here. And so let me give you some intuition about this. So where do these entropy bits come from? Well, one thing specifically, And that's that the interpulse interval, they fluctuate from reading to reading. Now, if you're a hardware person, you might imagine or think of this as jitter, right? So the change from a period, the change in period of a signal over time. And so you're getting these really minute fluctuations. But if you can isolate on these, this gives you some sort of entropy. Since I said earlier, I told you that we can't use these directly as they are, because if you're measuring in different places, they're going to be different enough that, well, you won't be able to compare them reasonably, or you won't be able to do some sort of key sharing. But if you do know the statistical characteristics, say over a 15-minute period, you'll look at these interpulse intervals, and you'll note that they start to shape a normal distribution. And if we take that normal distribution, and we can compute the average and standard deviation, we can actually divide our probability density function into, say, 16 consecutive bends. Now, if we do this and we look at over some data, what researchers have found, well, you know what? Each bend has a cumulative probability of 1 over the 16s. So each bend was getting equal probability. This is nice in crypto, right? And what's useful here, since it's 16 bends, you think of it as 2 to the 4th. So this is binary representation from 0000 to 1111. Yeah? And so this is precisely what I'm going to describe in the heart-to-heart authentication protocol. I'm going to describe that protocol at a high level, and I'm going to also describe adversarial assumptions, because it sort of leads into our research problem and marries well with our hypothesis. So this is how heart-to-heart starts. We have a TLS connection without certificates, and you say, well, this is madness. Why would you not have certs? Well, with the TLS, all we're looking for, or all the researchers are looking for here, is integrity and confidentiality. And authentication is going to come through the use of those interpulse intervals. So what ends up happening next is that both the clinician and the patient are going to be measuring the ECG of the patient at the time that the patient comes to the clinician, so at the same time. And they're both going to get their own value. What happens next is that the patient is going to send a cryptographic commitment of the ECG reading to the clinician. The clinician is going to send her cryptographic commitment of the ECG reading to the patient. And now the patient's going to go ahead and decommit his reading to the clinician. So what the clinician's going to do here is say, okay, you've revealed your value to me. I can compare it against the measure, the ECG signal that I measured earlier, and I can be able to compute these IPIs. And within some reasonable threshold, I should be able to compare the two. And if they're nearly the same, which is very close and tightly bounded, I can say, fine, we are measuring the same person at the same time. And if that's agreed, then I will go ahead as a clinician and decommit her own ECG reading to the patient such that the patient can do the same thing. Now, once again, if these values are close enough, authentication occurs. And so we wonder about protocols that are based on these interpulse intervals, because what we've seen so far is that researchers have relied on ideal data, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide. But just think that ideal data, it's not synthetic, but it's very controlled, so there's an experimental control there. And so what we're wondering is, well, okay, let's think about adversarial assumptions. And what comes out is that, okay, for this particular protocol, the assumptions are that you have an active attacker who has full network control, pretty powerful attacker, and that attacker is also present in an emergency situation. And you might imagine this is the worst time because the patient is incapacitated. Additionally, we might imagine pretend that the active attacker could remotely observe or correlate the ECG signal. Well, that would break the scheme too. But as we're assuming a very strong attacker, we'll keep that there. Next, we have adversarial limitations. And as for limitations, we consider that the adversary cannot compromise the programmer or mount a denial of service, because this just breaks the scheme altogether. This is not useful here, right? But we will also mention that, hey, there's the adversary doesn't have physical access to the patient. Well, that should be interesting to you as well. And so just keep in mind, that's why they're highlighted in red, there's two points that interest us as researchers, or me and my group. And we're interested in this remote observability, and we're interested in this limitation of, you know, you don't have physical access to the patient. And this is where we start driving sort of our research problem and asking more questions to try to result into more answers based on some empirical experimental methodology. And so what we're considering is that analysis so far, like I sort of alluded to, it has only relied on ideal data. So there's this thing called a PhysioNet database, which is provided by MIT, and it has cardiac waveforms that are measured in the clinical setting over some time. And it's easy, mind you, that I said, well, to make these schemes work, we're looking at statistical characteristics, right? We're computing means and standard deviations and looking at cumulative distribution functions. But if you have all this data available in one window, you're not measuring it in the real world, well, that's problematic, right? So this works with data that you've had, that you've sort of minimized any extraneous variables. But what happens in the real world when the patient is going to see the clinician and the clinician needs to authenticate and be able to change something on that implantable medical device? And so then we wonder even further, well, what about introducing biases? How does age or how does exertion sort of affect the entropy extraction on these four bits, right? Can we bias it towards least significant bit? Can we bias it towards most significant bit? If the heart rate is elevated, would it have an effect on this jitters on the IPI, or the interpulse interval, excuse me? And lastly, we're interested in observable events that correlate to ECG signal. So what in the real physical world can I look at that correlates well with the ECG signal, such that maybe I can extract the same fluctuations, and I can extract the same interpulse interval without even having to touch the patient? Well, this would be ideal, right? It would break the authentication's assumption that no physical access occurs. And so we've begun experimentation to prove just that. And what I have here are two pictures of the lab. If Kevin was here, I'd poke fun at him because it looks like stuff blew up everywhere. But what you see sort of in the corner here, we have a treadmill to test that exertion hypothesis, right? So how can I bias or influence these interpulse intervals? In the top corner, and I apologize, is a bit blurry, right? But what you sort of see is I have this camera, the camera tripod has a Raspberry Pi hooked to it with a camera module. So it's sampling at 30 frames per second. I have a human subject actually sit at a 3-foot mark. And I take video over some time because I'm trying to get to remote observability. So I'll talk about some post-processing techniques that I'm applying here. And getting to those techniques actually is I want to correlate ECG signal in the physical world without touching the patient. So what might I do? And there are two results from MIT that have very particular techniques for getting the pulse or being able to extract cardiac activity remotely. One is involuntary movements. So as blood goes through your carotid artery, it has a Newtonian force. And as you act on an object, it acts back at you with equal force. So as blood pulsates to the head, it creates an involuntary motion. And so if you were to capture some multiple frames of a person's head, you would be able to use principal component analysis and feature tracking, say of OpenCV, to be able to calculate the trajectory of velocities of head movement. And this correlates to the pulse, which may give us a good idea of what those interpulse intervals look like. For the second method, there's skin color changes. So with the Opta resolution of our eye, we have amazing resolution, but the great thing about computers is that when you're using a computer to look at video, this is based in pixels. So what the researchers have done here and the method that we're trying to use here as well is that as blood sort of flows through your face, as the heart pumps it up, you'll get minute fluctuations in pixels that say the red value will change. Now, if you look at the maximal frequency of that red value through your face, you should also be able to remotely observe the cardiac activity and thus learn something about the interpulse interval. And now my girlfriend's going to hate me, but I asked her if I could use her video, but she doesn't know it's taped. So these are, we're using the head movements in this video. And so if you can kind of see, it's a little blurry, but you might not notice any sort of movements, right? And these movements are within like 5 millimeters, so it's very hard to pick up with your eyes. And these are the involuntary movements. And never mind her trying to hide a smile, as I was also talking to her. We'll see how this biases the data. And so below that, I have what we're using is an ECG, because we need ground truth, right? We can't just make these assertions and not actually have ground truth. And so this is what her cardiac activity was looking like. These are the R peaks, or these are the heartbeats, and we can compute the time in between them. It's very nice and clean. And so what ended up happening when we apply this post-processing technique, we get this fairly noisy signal. This is preliminary work. I got to work on cleaning this up a bit. But what I noticed is that when I went back through the data, is that every sixth peak was close enough to those R peaks. Close enough that I could compute the error or the difference there in the percentage difference to see exactly how far off they were. And that's where we get into our preliminary results. Very exciting, right? So what we have is the ECG, which is the ground truth. So those R peak intervals are the times between the peaks. And they increase, of course. They shouldn't decrease or something's really wrong. And then this is the camera. So this is what the camera, where those distinct points were that I showed you in the last slide. And this is the percentage error. So we never go beyond 1.5 percentage error. And I might mention to you that Peter's pointed out to me before, I'm using a lower resolution camera. So the ECG machine is sampling at 128 hertz. So this is 128 samples a second. The camera that I'm using for my experimentation is at 30 frames per second. But what we're using here is a cubic spline. And this is an interpolation technique, which will take values and map them to larger sampling values. And so this might introduce some of the error that we're seeing. And so the next step to sort of see if we can decrease our error would be to use a very high resolution camera, so like the slow motion cameras, and be able to sample at frame rates between 128 to 250 frames per second, which would hopefully decrease this error rate by a lot. Now that we understand, this is sort of my attack to these protocols to say, hey, these protocols maybe might not make sense. Let's not use these implantable medical devices. We should, as good academic security researchers, think about potential defenses. And so this is very preliminary too, and hopefully I can get your thoughts on this during discussion. But some of the things that I've thought about so far, or at least I've sort of taken from other research, is that some researchers have proposed, well, let's use artificial signal injection that is below the action potential of other signals in the body, such that you can't get them remotely out of the body, because attenuate out before you could actually be able to get them. And can we use that artificial signal as A? Can we use it for our authentication? So I'm injecting a signal, so I have some reasonable sense of proximity. Or can I take that and can I just XOR it in with the IPI? Because we're not actually saying interpulse interval doesn't give you randomness. It's the extraction method or it's your true random number generator, what actually defines one of these. And you can get the greatest randomness in the world from, say, a true random number generator, but if it's, hey, Mike, I have a 1, now I have a 5, now I have a 10. Well, that's observability, and that means it's not good for this sort of use. Additionally, another potential defense that we started thinking about, but we don't have an idea of like which one to use, is does there exist any other unobservable physiological value? So most recently, I'd read about antibodies and how antibodies are based on mutations, genetic mutations, to fight off viruses, right, or viri. And it might be interesting if we could measure these, and would they provide a source of randomness? Because you might imagine to get an antibody, the process is a little more evasive than saying, all right, let's use these video post-processing techniques. Because if that was the case, then we'd solve all kinds of flu epidemics. And with that, I was going to say I'd take questions, but we have enough time, and I have discussion points. I'll read through them real quick, just in case maybe I can facilitate question asking. But some of the questions in my mind, at least as I'm going forward, that I want to be able to solve are, I want people's intuition. Are there other apparatuses or methods for remote observation? Maybe me looking at video is not the only solution. Maybe we can look at audio. Are there methods to improve post-processing accuracy? So I've seen software stacks now that can actually take video that's shot at a certain frame per second and increase that, but I don't know exactly what that would buy us. What other physiological values are there that might not be remotely observable? That'd be awesome. Does anyone have any inclination? And what about the effect of the Internet of Things? So if we're all wearing integrated devices, is it reasonable to say that the adversary doesn't have physical contact? So if I'm wearing a smartwatch, it's running an Android stack, I have homed your watch, therefore, in theory, I have obtained physical access to you, and if it's in the context of physical healthcare or something, maybe it has sensors that such that I can measure ECG. And so that's it. Yeah, thanks.
Hi, Eugene Wasserman, Kansas State University. This is a joke inadvertently taken from Futurama, but when I thought about it for a little while, I thought that this may be a really good idea. When Fry tries to log into his bank, they said they have neither his fingerprints, nor his retinal scan, nor his colonic map on file. And I thought about the third one. It's really hard to rearrange, which means it's really hard to get a targeted one compiled. It's hard to observe remotely. It's probably, given the length of your small intestine, extremely different for different people, although I don't have any hard data on that. That may be, assuming we can observe it, a really, really good biometric. So here's a place where humor becomes truth. That may be something to consider.
Great, that's fantastic. Yeah, I hadn't considered.
I have no idea, but the value, part of the value of this is it's a joke which has more research potential than most other, any other biometric joke I've heard, at least.
So thanks.
API, you don't have an internal device that can also measure that.
Not yet.
Nanobots.
Actually, the transit time of any physical object, we have smart pills now.
Yep.
So you can just directly take the transit time of that.
Let's move on. Saigar Ojala, University of Michigan. So I was wondering if you looked at research literature that exists that looks at authentication maybe using like the EEG or the electroencephalogram, because I think that you can couple, well, one of the artifacts of the EEG signal is an ECG, so if you can measure both the ECG physically and then somehow correlate it with the EEG, then you sort of knock out this remote observability.
There you go.
Sure. And I haven't considered that. And I also wonder what the actual fluctuations or properties of the EEG signal exist, if it's the same as cardiac activity. So in the medical literature, healthy hearts tend to be chaotic in nature between beats of the heart, which doesn't sound intuitive to most people. You would assume that they're very deterministic and fixed, but this is not the case. It's more the case for when people have, say, arrhythmias, that you get a deterministic signal out of the heart because it's indicative of something that's, because your body is supposed to adapt. It's sort of a fractal design. And as things change in the physical world, they change in your physical body, and that's why it's kind of nice. So if the EEG represents similar findings, I think, yeah, that would be kind of nice.
They would likely have
more guessable entropy, and now I can't quantify it with a value, but I think it's interesting to look at because it hasn't been. So my argument earlier is they've only looked at, you know, these PhysioNet databases, and so it's really clean and annotated, but in the real world, yes, you want to protect the person that has an implantable medical device. If this is a pacemaker and they exhibit better, like, deterministic heart rates, then their entropy would also be bad.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Carl.